And hello from Damien O'Mara, and you're welcome to this week's edition of the RTE Soccer Podcast. So on the way over the next hour or so, hyped to within an inch of its life, but then failing to live up anywhere close to expectation, we'll look back on the English Premier League weekend, including that meeting of Liverpool and Manchester United at Anfield. At home, more and more clubs getting their houses in order as they hope to launch into pre-season ahead of the League of Ireland resumption. Carl Shepherd brings the curtain down on his career at the age of 29, and we'll chat to Owen Hand on the ongoing cycle of storms which seem to be engulfing the senior national side and manager Stephen Kenny. So all of that to come over, I was going to say the next hour or so, but perhaps James O'Toole, if we get down to business, we'll try and be succinct and not bore people too much.
We'll try our best. We'll try our best, Damien, but you never know. We're all teachers now, Damien, so we can teach people stuff today.
Yeah, I learned today, Schlia Stock, Schlia Mock, entrance, exit. Popcorn, do you know what popcorn is in Irish?
I'd say it's popcorn, is it?
No. It's like corn roasty. So these are all the... People didn't expect to be listening to this as we started into it. So the list of words that we brought from 2020 into 2021, which we never want to hear again, wet pubs, the new normal, the new reality, and homeschooling can be added to all of that for me. So anyway, from my kitchen, which is now a radio studio, which was earlier a classroom and might be used later on to actually make the dinner, to your kitchen, it's the new world. This is what we're putting up with.
You almost used one of those 2020 words there, Damien.
The new normal.
We've got to put some of them aside. We've got to leave them where they were. Okay, yeah, fake news as well, surely one of them, is it?
Yeah, I saw someone had on Twitter at some point over Christmas that you'd love to just return to precedented times because we're so sick of unprecedented times. But will we have the audacity to talk about football?
I suppose we may as well, since I think that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, well, that's what it says above the door. So we're going to chat, as mentioned, to Owen Hand shortly. Dominic McGuinness is going to join us as well to look back on the meeting of Liverpool against Manchester United, which, in hindsight, was hyped so much we should have realised it was going to fail to live up to expectation. Carl Shepherd is going to join us in a minute. But I'm looking, we're in this situation where League of Ireland clubs, and I know you've touched on this in the past, have a notional date that they're going to start back to action. Obviously, as restrictions continue, particularly around collective training, that date is going to get pushed back further and further. Really difficult for clubs to plan, particularly financially. But again, over the course of the weekend, some very, very significant transfer business being done.
Yeah, it's fair play to the clubs for going out and doing it. Like, you look at Derry got the two or three players, other clubs have signed in players. It's quite unusual, really, because you said that they have no date when they're due to go back to pre-season. Some are now talking probably the second week in February they may be able to go back. But at the minute, they have no idea. As you mentioned yourself, they've no clue of budgets. There doesn't seem to be any finance agreement so far from the league. There doesn't seem to be a sponsor for the league. There doesn't seem to be a TV package put in place at the moment as well. Now, the FAI are suggesting all that should be wrapped up very, very shortly. But as Kona mentioned it last week, even the league in the north is on a break at the moment, and that's in limbo as to whether it'll come back or not. And you've seen some clubs in England this weekend as well also suggesting that unless funds start coming into them, whether their leagues will even continue. So it's not just us here in Ireland who are in a limbo at the moment as well as finances or when a ball is going to be kicked or how a ball is going to be kicked.
Mm. And, but you know, before we bring Carl in and have a chat with Carl about his retirement, you know, you're in that situation as well where if we look at Gaelic games, the third level competitions have been postponed. You look at soccer in Northern Ireland where they're talking about bringing in a testing regime. Now, I know I was having a bit of a back and forth with Dave Henderson on Twitter about this over the weekend, that's all well and good and it's admirable. And if it gets the league up and running, brilliant. But the problem with it all is who's going to pay for it? And that seems to be the eternal question in all of these things.
That's a major problem. Like, unfortunately, football here, although it should be an actual business, it's not a business. It's essentially an amateur sport, bar one or two clubs. Finances, testing players week in, week out, is not cheap. You see how many tests are done in the Premier League, but the money is there in the Premier League to go ahead and do that kind of stuff. Doing tests here, and it's not just the testing. Like, at least in the Premier League, you can keep people in bubbles. With here, because we're an amateur team, and people have to work during the week, like, do you know what I mean? So you can't keep them in bubbles to make sure that the testing is done properly and everything moves on. And when you just look at our R rate at the moment is so high, the amount of cases we have at the minute, even testing, will it work? Because from one day to the next, you don't know whether a player is going to have it or not.
Mm. And the other issue as well is, and I know there's an awful lot of people, and again, even, you know, RTE released viewership figures for television programs for 2020, and sport was very prominent. And I know there's an argument that goes on time and time again that it's really important to so many people that sport continues. But it's equally as important to an awful lot of people that the country just gets back to normal and sport isn't at the forefront of their minds. But the problem you have, particularly with the League of Ireland, you would think that it's in such a fragile state that were it not to continue and to maintain some level of existence and activity, it's going to be very hard to get back to anywhere close to where we're at, let alone where a lot of people want to be.
Yeah, and that's a very valid point. And we've seen, like, people's lives have just changed full stop. Sport, yes, it does give people a lot of positives. It's great to watch it and stuff like that. But at the same time, you can't expect players to go out and put themselves in danger if the testing and stuff like that isn't there. And it's not just the players, it's the players' families as well. Like, several players have young children, and one or two, even last year, there was one or two talking about how their partners were pregnant and were worried about it. So, yes, it'd be great for it to get back up and running. Yes, it's needed. I think for the League of Ireland, the finances need to be there, or else, as you mentioned, some clubs may not survive this.
Yeah, well, we'll no doubt a topic which will be returned to time and time again. So anyway, let's press on and chat about some of the stories of the week. And a man who I suppose would love to be taking part in pre-season and have a season to look forward to, but that's not to be the case. Carl Shepherd, who announced his retirement from the game over the weekend at the age of 29. I'm delighted to say Carl joins us on the line. Carl, how are you?
I'm not too bad. I don't know if I can agree with it. I'd love to be a part of pre-season again, but definitely I am missing out on the season.
Well, yeah, if you could launch straight into the first weekend of games without having to do the bleep tests and the lactic tests and everything else along the way, that'd be the ideal situation, I presume.
Yeah, a lot of my teammates at Cork City would have probably said that was just a normal pre-season for me anyway, that I seem to get an ongoing niggling hamstring injury throughout pre-season and then it'd be miraculously better on the last week of pre-season.
Yeah, which I'd go along with that myself. Let's have a bit of a chat. Like, you've got such a coloured career to look back on, one that you've drawn the curtain down on over the weekend, and I think it's fair to assume, or you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I certainly read your statement and I had a look at a man who would like to go on, but basically you're in that situation, as with so many other people, where you just need to listen to your body.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Look, I loved every minute of playing in the League of Ireland, and I honestly tried absolutely everything to be able to play next season, but I suppose for the last two seasons my body's been in serious agony, and I suppose it was getting to a point now where I had to sort of just weigh up the options and say, if I do another year or two, it could be potentially where I'm not walking right for the rest of my life, or it could have ongoing effects on my body. So I was saying, look, now has to be the time where I've had nights up at night where I've been in agony, not able to sleep right, and it's just time to listen to the body and say, now's the time to stop.
Mm. So I know you've spoken about this in the past, but just for people that perhaps have missed out on it, you've obviously been battling with arthritis, and is it an overactive immune system as well?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So I have psoriatic arthritis, which is basically an overactive immune system. So my body basically attacks any inflammation within my body. So it attacks tendons especially. So I've had ongoing problems in my back, my knees, even my wrists and my thumbs have been giving me a fair bit of agony over the last while. But thankfully, in terms of football, I say we're well away from the throw-in, so that hasn't been too bad. But just in terms of my back and my knee, it's been pretty bad for the last, let's say, 2 years, definitely, even slightly three.
I remember last year you were on with us and you were telling us about what you were doing in between games to help prolong your actual career. So obviously, it's just got to the stage now where that can't happen anymore, obviously.
Yeah, it's exactly it. Like, it's about 3 years now since I've been diagnosed with the arthritis, and since then I've So it's the first year I went on a completely vegan-based diet of just a plant-based diet to see if that would help. Apparently it can help with inflammation. That was no luck. I've tried different types of steroids, steroid injections, which I take. I've gone from taking one weekly to now to two every month. So I've literally tried everything that I can, from training more, training less, more gym, less gym, but I've never been able to find anything that's, I suppose, been able to keep my body right. And it just wouldn't be right for me to keep continuing on as well. It's not right to clubs as well for me to be, I suppose, playing when I can't be right. Last year, I felt I really let Shelburne down because I wasn't able to give, I suppose, 100% Carl Shepherd to the club, and that's not right on me and not right on my teammates.
And particularly in a situation, Carl, where, you know, increasingly we've got either semi-pro football or, you know, increasing level of amateur football in many ways, that I presume the fatigue that's involved must be debilitating in many ways, that it's very difficult to balance all aspects of your life.
Yeah, it is. It's funny you say the fatigue. That's one of the, I suppose, the biggest things was it is very fatiguing on the body. Like I say, up if you watched my games from when I was 19 up until I was about 26, one of my big pros as a player was that I'd always run my socks off, and I suppose had a very good work rate. And then I suppose fans, if they looked at my last 2 years, they possibly have said that guy's not trying as much as he used to, but I'd be trying even more so now, but the body just wouldn't be able to do it. And even outside of football, it's the recovery time in between games and training would be possibly tenfold needed in comparison to what I used to.
You say that, but you look back at even your league appearances over the last 3 years, what, about 60 or 70 games over the last 3 years, when you add in cups and league cups and stuff like that, so you're still putting a fair shift in, like.
Yeah, look, I suppose the best people to ask would have been my physios and my teammates of what it was actually like for me in between games. It was horrific. I remember for 2019 season with Cork, my girlfriend has a little one, and pretty much during the week I couldn't pick up the little one. My back was that bad, and it was really taking effect on, I suppose, not just my body but mentally as well. It was very tough to deal with, and I suppose as well as that you have pressures of then making sure you get out for the game and doing everything you can. And even when I was out on the pitch, I wasn't, let's say my name would have been on the back of the shirt, but it wasn't truly me that was out there. It was, I suppose, a shell of the player, just because, as I said, look, the body was giving up on you. And while I'd always give 100%, I just felt that 100% of having arthritis is probably 60-70% old Carl Shepherd.
And Carl, just, and again, we'll chat about football in a minute, and not to pry too much or not to get too personal about it, but what impact do you think it can have on your life then, just in terms of managing the condition to walk away from football and make what is a very, very difficult decision, but one we would all hope that's for the benefit of your overall quality of life?
Yeah, I'm hoping that, as I mentioned, I take two injections every month now to, I suppose, keep the pain at bay. And in everyday life, it's not too bad. I have, I suppose, last year there was times where I wasn't able to really walk up the stairs right, and I'd be walking upstairs sideways, and trying to have a job and do that, it's not ideal. So I just think longer term, if I suppose, keep active, that's the main thing for arthritis, that they actually promote you keeping active. So keeping active without, I suppose, putting too many demands on the body that it can't live up to.
And would you like to stay involved in the game, or what do you see your future, you know, the relationship with football being?
Yeah, my relationship with football, I'd love to stay involved in the game and do some coaching. And I suppose, look, while I'm still fairly young, I'm ambitious about going into coaching and hopefully one day coaching in the League of Ireland, if not management. So I've currently got my UEFA B, and I'm in the process of getting my UEFA A. So it's something that this year I'm hoping to maybe do a bit of underage work in the League of Ireland.
Would Shelburne be a place to go back to with the underage work? Because obviously Damien Duff there as part of it would be great for you as a coach to be under his wing as well and see how he works.
Yeah, I know that Damien's there. I'd probably say he has his hands full with, I say, applications of people trying to get in with him. So I have spoke with Shelburne about possibly getting, I suppose, a bit of work with them in the underage structure. And look, if I happen to come across Damien, you know, I've heard amazing things about his sessions, and I know Luke Byrne has done a bit of coaching with him, and he said how brilliant he is. So it's certainly something that if I came across me, I'd love to do. But I'm sure he has his hand full with people trying to get in and watch his sessions.
Carl, just when you reflect on the career you've had from, you know, heading over to Everton in your teens and then coming home and having played for, you know, in Shamrock Rovers and Cork City, two of the biggest clubs you could have played for within the League of Ireland. I don't know how much reflection you've done, but you've an awful lot of positives and an awful lot of great days to look back on.
Yeah, I do. I suppose when I look back on my Shamrock Rovers days, to be so lucky to be a part of the Belgrade night and the Europa League nights that followed, they were amazing. I have such fond memories from them, and I've made friends from life through at Shamrock Rovers that I still be in contact with this day. And then to top that, obviously some great years with Cork City. And I suppose when I look back at my time at Cork City, it won't be so much of winning trophies, etc. I look back at the games against Dundalk and the rivalry we had there, and just I suppose how great I suppose it was to be playing in a top team against another top team at the time. And I suppose it's just great memories of them games, especially what we have four in a row with the Aviva with them. So it was it was a great time to look back on, but I'm sure I've probably a few more years ahead of me where I'll just start to look back on it more and I suppose reminisce a bit.
Just you talked there about the rivalries, and you know you were one of those players that the clubs you went to, they really took you to your heart, but you often got, I won't say a warm welcome, but certainly a colourful welcome in other grounds that you played in. And I often, you know, certainly would have watched you play against Bowes and Dalymount, and I'm thinking to myself, here's a fella who just revels in this sense of, I don't know, tension is probably the wrong word to use, but you enjoyed that side of the game, the not necessarily winding people up, but the competitive aspect of going to play against certain clubs or going to play in front of certain fans.
Yeah, 100%. I say Bowes will be taking applications now for who they can, I suppose, hate the most in the League of Ireland. So I say they're disappointed in some way that I'm retiring. But I did. I certainly loved every minute of it. And even when, as I said, I mentioned it when I was retiring, the cheers of the away fans, like, it was something that really got me revved up for each game. And if you're playing bad and away fans are on your back, they're only going to get on your worse. So I suppose it just made me be like, right, these are giving me a bit of stick today, time to give them a bit back. And I loved every minute of it, to be honest.
You already mentioned the night in against Partizan where you win a penalty, goal goes in, Rovers go through. But what I want to know a bit more is the goal against Pauk in Thessaloniki, because the crowd are mental out there. What was that game like, and what was it taking the goal as well?
Yeah, it was... I remember I look back on it now, and Gary Twigg was due to start up front and I was due to start on the wing, and Twiggy at the time got injured, and Michael just pulled me in and said, look, you're starting up front. And to be starting up front at the age of, I think I was 18, 19, and in the Europa League away against Pauk, as you mentioned, they've got fans who are absolutely crazy. It was a very intimidating atmosphere, but it was the score as well. I remember being on such a high on the plane on the way home, being like, I've just scored in the Europa League. This is madness. So it was great as well. And to top that, it was a game that we probably should have got something out of. We were all very happy with how we played. And I suppose, look, it would have been nicer to be, a goal that got our first point in the group, but it wasn't to be.
And then you move on, obviously, to Cork City. Good period in Cork City. A couple of FAI Cups as well. That must have been great. Because when you consider you come back to Rovers and then off you went to Cork, and it was a great side you had at Cork, in fairness. Like, when you went almost unbeaten for the entire season, it was just an absolute wonder to watch.
Yeah, it was, to be honest, it was such a joy to play in. And for the guts of maybe 18 months, it was a really, really enjoyable team to be part of. We went into most games thinking, right, let's steamroll this team today. We went up to Oriel Park and beat what some people were calling the best ever Dundalk team, beat them 3-0 up there. And we were thinking, whoever we're playing, let's go beat them 3-4-5. And really, it was a really, really enjoyable team to play and be a part of. And not just that, there were great lads in that team who, to this day, and I'm sure for many years to come, I'll be good friends with.
As far as career highlight, I know the Fingal Sportsman of the Year is definitely up there. But as far as your league is concerned, what would have been your highlight game or your highlight moment?
Possibly... Maybe the cup final against Dundalk, where I was pretty much being tipped to sign for Dundalk, and I suppose I went into the game with a lot of pressure on my back, and I suppose I gave one of my better performances for Cork City in that final, and had a big scored a penalty in the shootout and got an assist in the game, and remember coming out of that going, thank God I played well today. If I didn't, I suppose there would have been a lot of stick coming my way.
Like, if you look back at what you've won the Premier Division, you've won the Setanta Cup, you've won everything bar the League Cup. And you were close, were you close in one or two? I think you were close to Cork, maybe, I think, against Derry 1 year. But that's about the only blot on your career, would you say?
I've actually won the League Cup with Shamrock Rovers early on. So I suppose when it was the EA Sports Cup back then was when we won it. So thankfully, I'm pretty sure on that I've won everything twice in the league. So that's I look back on that fondly and go, you know what, I've anything that was there to be accomplished in the league, I've thankfully been able to do it now. Would I have liked more leagues and more cups? 100%. But I suppose that would be me being picky.
Carl, we wish you well with the next chapter, and most importantly, wish you continued good health and, you know, with the managing of the condition which has forced you to retire. Thank you very much for the memories, even if some of them were maybe unnecessary chants from the Jody and Daily Mount. You know, it was all good natured fun along the way. Thanks so much for being with us, and we wish you well with the future.
Cheers. Thanks, man.
That's Carl Shepherd, who's been joining us there to reflect on his career and his decision to make, you know, I suppose a very, very difficult decision for an awful lot of footballers to decide to hang up their boots and retiring at the age of 29 due to that ongoing management of an arthritic condition. We're going to press on and continue with one of the other big stories of the week. And again, I suppose it's unnecessary attention on Stephen Kenny and the senior international side with the departure of Alan Kelly and Damien Duff from his management team, and delighted to say that former Republic of Ireland manager Owen Hand joins us. Owen, how are you?
I'm fine, Damien. I'm fine. Everything is good. Doing as best we can, given the circumstances.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. It's been an awful long time, so it's great to reconnect. Just before we get stuck into this, it's going to be very difficult for a lot of us to make sense of what's going on, because there's so many different conflicting messages and different opinions being played out, particularly through the media, which tends to be the case. But at the back of all of this, with results the way they have gone, is this just all unnecessary attention and focus that Stephen Kenny and the players involved with the senior side could just do without at the moment?
Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, there is no... Look, we do know that it will come out about why are all these things happening, you know, that are negative. Now the negative influence is coming on, particularly the two latest ones with Damien Duff and Alan Kelly. You can go back to players like, and even say McGoldrick. I mean, that was strange in itself. You know, it wasn't very convincing when the fellow was first choice for Ireland, or certainly was up there. So it'll all come out. But, you know, there's bound to be stories and all these different opinions and whatever, and it was most of them just supposition. And it would be much better if it could be explained. You know, the whole thing about the stuff at before the England match and all that, that was all very vague, the whole thing, the way it was handled. But, I mean, there's no doubt about it, as far as I'm concerned, that was a mistake. That was a big mistake to do that sort of thing, because there's nothing to do with football, and it wasn't even a thing to say that you were setting the tone for a game against England. I think that that would go down as a big mistake by going ahead with that kind of thing. And of course, it made headlines, you know. And I think, as a consequence of that, I would imagine that, well, not imagine, I think it's that the two, Duff and Damien Duff and Alan Kelly, two great losses, by the way, that's caused, I think that's behind that, the whole thing that went on there. But we don't know that, we don't know for sure. Mm. So it's the vagueness about the whole thing is kind of... I do know that, I mean, my opinion of the whole thing is that... never mind, say, the COVID thing, because everybody had the problems with that. You know, that was anybody we played. Okay, ours might have been worse. But it is all down to results at the end of the day. And I just feel that, you know, I think that, Stephen, if anybody has got to learn out of what has gone on since he came in, it's Stephen himself. Like, I mean, he really should kind of think, well, hold on a second, maybe this is the wrong way, and maybe this, it's got to be done a bit more gradual, and then we mightn't have had some of the problems that we had, you know. So that's my opinion.
the problem that's going to develop here is we've got a game against Serbia on the 24th of March, and it's now another unnecessary sideshow, which one would imagine, if it's not nipped in the bud in advance of that, will dominate every press event in the run-up to that, what is a crucial game.
Well, that's why that there should be a clarity about exactly the reasons why. Yeah, because they obviously had very good reasons, the two of them, Damien Duff and Alan Kelly. You know, I mean, a massive kind of loss, you know, because they had great careers, you know, and all the way through, and were very, very good at what they were doing. And you know, Stephen actually brought them on board because of the respect that they would have, which he might necessarily have because he wasn't a player. You know, he wasn't a career player. His whole career was in successful, was in management at mainly Dundalk, as we know. But so I do think that really it would be that is a huge issue. I mean, to leave a kind of a cloud over it and just let it drift along, I don't think that's helping the situation.
But then part of the challenge then, Owen, and you know, you've managed at international level and you know what's required in order to put together a management team, that is there a balancing act now to bring in a highly impressive coach who will impress the players, but does it have to be a name now that the players are going to go, well, we've lost Damien Duff, who had 100 caps for Ireland. We lost Alan Kelly, who went to whatever number of international tournaments and had the legacy with Irish football that he had as a result of his family connections. How important is the replacement and the recruitment that Stephen now has to do in the course of whatever it is, 8 to 10 weeks?
It's very important. It's very important. But, I mean, no matter who it is, it has to be somebody that the players will respect. You know, that's vital. You know, if they think that, you know, somebody's come on board just for the sake of, and he's whatever. But no, it must be somebody that they would have respect for. And you cannot demand respect. You know, players just don't accept that. You know, just you've got to actually prove that you can contribute something that would be very, very positive. So that is very important.
So what kind of, are we talking another former player on, or are we talking somebody, a coach that people would recognise from around Europe, or what type of person
well, yeah,
are we
I mean,
talking
look
about?
Look at either of them, but like I come back to it, will the players respect, if that doesn't happen, well then you're creating a rod for your own back type of thing. I mean, if they have to really work harder, particularly when the results have gone so poor, you know, so everybody's looking at the Serbia game and just, you know, saying, well, okay, fine, depending on how that will go. Because when you boil it all down, I mean, whoever's in charge of the international team, it's all about results, you know, and it's how do you go about getting those results. So, okay, these are all things that lead up to getting a team that's going to get out there and going to be performing. And if they're not performing at 100%, given the fact that it's a tough away game, well, then, fine, you're giving yourself a problem, an unnecessary problem type of thing. So you have to be all kind of singing off the same hymn sheet, as they say. You know, so you can say, well, you know, a name or a this and that, whatever. But there's so much has gone wrong during the time since Stephen has taken over that, I mean, there are bigger issues behind his, shall we say, evolutionary style, I think. You know, on a more general conversation, I think that he must revisit the way that he has declared publicly that he was going to do things. You know, in other words, sort of an evolutionary style and identity. There's a very, very simple kind of thing there that you don't try and build from the top down. You build anything from the bottom up. And, you know, really, that kind of brings you into the thinking of, well, you know, it's a question of, do you have a principle of, do you have a system that suits the players that you have available, or do you have players to suit the system that you want to play? Well, that hasn't been, you know, the evidence that we've seen, it hasn't been the case. And I use a great example, say, the likes of Shane Duffy, who is a very, very steady rock player, like a really kind of bastion. But, I mean, really, he was being asked to do something that he wasn't used to. And consequently, he wasn't the same player. Like, I mean, Jordan Stevens at the time was there. Now, okay, finally got the goal out in Bulgaria, or whatever it was. But, I mean, that's a general kind of overlook that you, when you've only got an international team together for the minimal time that you have, you've got to accept that those players are training every day a certain way, system, with their clubs. Day in, day out, week in, week out, for what, 9, 10 months? And then you've got them for a few days, and you're asking them to do something different. That is giving yourself a huge problem. And I use Shane Duffy as a good example. You know, so it's, I mean, if you go into that and you want to really go a little bit deeper into it, really, when I'm saying about building from the bottom up, you have to go back, and we're going back to the previous regime, and I was involved at the time. The way to do that is to have a national academy, you know, whereby players are tutored from an early age, the elite players from all over the country. And this is where there's a huge, huge, shall we say, shortage of the right training, because it's all done willy-nilly all over the place. There's no cohesive strategy about what way. And you've got, I mean, I was talking to Niall Quinn, and we were just yapping about it and whatever, and Niall and myself were the same views about the academy that should have happened under Delaney's reign. And again, I was involved in that, going back as far as when the move to Abbottstown had just happened and all that. There was supposed to be a national academy. And that's where you will build from the bottom up. In other words, those players, now I know from first-hand experience that other countries, that's what they do. Like, I mean, Norway was a good example that I actually went and visited when I was working for RTE, when I was out there. I met with my equivalent, shall we say, and talking about their system, whereby, education and sport was complementary to each other, whereas here it's in conflict, you know, about players going across and, you know, what age do they go over at, and do they leaving cert before they go? Well, you know, they go at an age when, if now not as much as they have been in yesteryear, because the whole scene has changed over there. There's global recruitment now. You know, it's changed for all the home countries, never mind Ireland. So you've got to look at a much bigger picture to say, what sort of an identity do you want to be to create within the whole structures of football in this country, that you get the elite players coming through a certain way that gives a license for them to express our national identity. Now, that's a very deep subject, but it's a very basic one as well. You know, again, building from the bottom up.
There's a very significant impact that Brexit is going to have on the development of Irish players, which I think we're not going to have time to cover now, but perhaps might be something for us to come back to in the weeks ahead. Thank you very much for your time, as always, and stay safe. Thanks, Owen.
Okay. All right. Bye.
That's former Republic of Ireland manager Owen Hand, who's with us there. James, did you sit down engrossed in Liverpool against Man United yesterday?
No, I didn't. I must admit, I didn't actually get a chance to watch it. I did actually put on a bit of, I put on Sky Sports News before it, and probably about 5 or 10 minutes into it, my good old pal Clint Morrison was on, and he guaranteed there would be goals.
Well, yes, so. And he will still get a gig on Sky Sports again next week, because I was thinking to myself that there was some, and how these things work in television. There was some sub-editor somewhere who spent hours last week putting together a first against second package that was going to go out before the game, and then Leicester screwed the whole thing up for them by, you know, knocking Liverpool down the table. So, yeah, I think there is definitely a parallel to be drawn between how much these games are hyped by broadcasters, perhaps ourselves included, and what they actually end up being. So let's chat Premier League. Dominic McGuinness joins us from Manchester. Hiya, Dominic.
Hiya, Damien. You okay?
I'm not too bad. It didn't live up to the expectation, and, you know, the leg-breaking tackles that we might have had between Liverpool and United in times long, long ago now at this stage, such as the way the game has gone. But surely United, if they're honest this morning, they must be looking at that game thinking Liverpool were there for the taking.
Well, without doubt. And, you know, the key chances, obviously, in the second half, Pogba is the one that stands out, but Rashford, Fernandes as well, opportunities. No doubt about it, the clearer chances were with Manchester United, despite Liverpool's dominance in the first half. So it was, given Liverpool's problems with injury and the fact that they've just dried up a little bit up front as well, it was an opportunity for Manchester United to extend the lead at the top. And they'll know that. But obviously, going to Anfield and coming away with a point, given where the two clubs have been over the last few years, is a good result. But yeah, I'd say opportunity missed.
Just when we look at United under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and had we been chatting before Christmas, we would have been talking about the potential for him to have been replaced before the window opened, and were the Glazers willing, or, you know, Ed Woodward willing to make a big decision. You now look at them top of the table and well and truly in what will be a title race. As someone who sees the club at much closer quarters, what impact has he made in terms of the changing of the culture within Man United post Mourinho and Van Gaal and Moyes, and maybe trying to get United back to where it was at under Ferguson in terms of how it goes about its business?
Well, I think you just touched upon it there. I mean, it's a name that will never go away whenever you talk about Solskjaer and the impact that he's made and why he's there and why he was brought back. It's Sir Alex Ferguson. You know, they tried to get back to basics with bringing Ole Gunnar Solskjaer back. I mean, let's not forget, it wasn't just his kind of impact at Manchester United as a player over the years. You know, he coached there. He was reserve team boss. When he struggled with injury, he was taking part in coaching sessions as well. So he'd been part of the furniture for a long time on the pitch and off the pitch as well. Then he went away, as we know, with Mulder, with Cardiff, Mulder again, and then back to Manchester United. But it's the familiarity. He went back to also Alex's old kind of ways in terms of the way that everyone is treated at the training ground. Everybody knows everybody's name. You know, if you look at the team now that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has around him, Mick Phelan coming back and Michael Carrick staying where he was, now Darren Fletcher coming back in as well, which is a huge boost. I mean, Fletcher's delighted to be back at Manchester United, and again, he's a fantastic addition to the squad. But it's a United man through and through. That's what he's brought back, and that's why the fans were so happy to pay him to come back. Obviously, though, when things aren't happening on the pitch, you're going to get it. And Manchester United, probably more so than any other club, if it's not happening on the pitch, if it isn't the style of football that the fans want to see, he's going to get it. But if you think back to the beginning of November when United lost to Arsenal, there didn't seem to be a future for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer whatsoever. At that point, it really did seem that with Pochettino still hovering in the background, it was going to be a long autumn stroke winter, or he could be out the door. But as we know, the run that they've been on and where they sit now atop the table, apart from the Champions League little blip, if you like, everything else has gone pretty smoothly. Apart from defeat to Manchester City, of course, in the League Cup semi. But, you know, the bigger priority is to try and stay where they are in the Premier League. That's got to be number one.
But if there's to be a criticism then of United and the top brass at the club, is it that it wasn't articulated enough that this is not just a man who is here to hopefully win silverware, or with the intention of winning silverware, but this is a man that we have brought back to the club to bring about, you know, psychological change is the wrong, but philosophical change, that, you know, perhaps the terms of engagement should have been more publicly stated to take some of the pressure off him?
Yeah, well, I think it's a bit trial and error, though. And I think it has been since Sir Alex left. You know, we know about the whole high-profile managers that came in. David Moyes was the future, 6-year contract, didn't happen. Louis van Gaal, obviously Ryan Giggs had a very brief interim spell. Then Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho, the big guns came in and it didn't happen. There was complete change each time in terms of backroom staff and everything else. And I think it was a case from Ed Woodward and the board. It was kind of, well, you know, what do we do now? And remember, Solskjaer was an interim manager. You know, he was there as a short-term fix. So I think it was a feeling-out process, and it's kind of, is this going to work, is it not? There couldn't be any bold statements from the top, because I don't really think anybody knew how it was going to work out, or would it work out? And then obviously he gets the job, you know, full time. So there's a show of trust there. But it's still very much, you know, the naysayers, well, which other top six elite club around the world would employ Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? Nobody. That was always the thing that was thrown at Solskjaer. Now it's kind of, well, you know, does this fella get the club? Does he understand what it's all about? Does he know how to tackle the big managers tactically in the big games? It would appear that he does on the whole. So it's changed. So there couldn't be any bold statements about Solskjaer really being the man, because I don't think anybody knew.
I think, as you said, he's learned. I think this whole thing with Fletcher coming back in particular, it seems to be maybe a discussion was had with Alex Ferguson about that and how to build his backroom staff. And the familiarity of these guys back in and their coaching and their availability to players to help players along, He seems to have learned that over the last couple of months, if nothing else.
Yeah, and dare I say it, you know, I'm sure people remember the famed Anfield boot room, you know, in terms of the way that Liverpool used to do it with all the familiar faces around the place and people kind of being promoted from within. There's an element of that now with Manchester United, with guys stepping through from the academy into the first team coaching setup, people that have played their football at the club and have come through the system there. So I think that's very much the way that, you know, again, there's lots of cliches when people talk about Manchester United now, about the United DNA and the style of football. And again, it has brought Sir Alex Ferguson very much back into the forefront, because it does feel like he's very much more engaged now with everything at the club. You know, he had a recent that Zoom event with Gareth Southgate, Jurgen Klopp, and obviously talking about the respect, and Kenny Dalglish as well, and they're talking about obviously all the history between the clubs and the way it's all, you know, and there's a sense now that Manchester United does have Sir Alex around the place again, if you like. It certainly wasn't the case when Jose Mourinho was in position, and Louis van Gaal as well. So I think that the whole thing just does feel very much more Manchester United. That said, you know, a run of bad results and Solskjaer's going to get it again.
Just before we wrap up, so we've United, we're chatting Monday afternoon. We've United top of the table, 37 points from 18 games played. City 2 points back with a game in hand. And then it is really tight all the way down to Everton in sixth place. To me, I'm looking at Man City as the team that are in the box seat to push on and win the Premier League. But may I be audacious enough to suggest we might actually have a title race that could go down to April or May?
Well, I think everyone's kind of hoping so. Obviously, everyone supports their own teams, but you look at it, it is fascinating. I think Manchester City, you know, their progress into second position in the table didn't suit the narrative of the weekend. I think you touched on it before. You know, all the chat was about Liverpool and Manchester United, and you know, it's back to these two going for a title, and Manchester City almost quietly, even though they're the favourites, going about their business. Now look where they are. They win the game in hand. They play Aston Villa on Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Manchester United are away at Fulham, 8:15 kickoff. So Manchester City can be top of the table, you know, before Manchester United take the field. Now that's kind of, as I say, slightly under the radar. It seems mad given Manchester City's recent success. But looking the way they're shaping up now, with the defence seems to be sorted now with Stones and Diaz, and with all the talent going forward, and when you've got the best player in the Premier League in Kevin De Bruyne, you know, you've got any team should be fearing Manchester City.
We look further, slightly further down the table to 11th, Arsenal. Have they got that white elephant out of the room now with Ozil moving on? Is that going to help Arsenal maybe gel a bit more?
It might well help morale a little bit. It might, you know, obviously I think there's players and the management that will be glad to see the back of Ozil, but I think they've still got an awful lot to do, haven't they? It's been a turbulent season. As I think, you know, again, it's a season and the end of last season, but hopefully we're not going to see again. It's just crazy. Going to these matches behind closed doors and reporting and commentating on them, it's not right, and everyone's kind of trying to do the very best that you can in the circumstances, but it's very, very hard to judge everything when you look at it all. It's quite such a surreal, unusual situation that even Arsenal and Arteta, and it's hard to judge everybody on this season or alone. It'd be just interesting, obviously, at the end of the season, where everyone, if Arteta's weathered the turbulence and obviously managed to get his stamp a little bit more and everything, I still think he's going the right way and they should obviously stick with him. I know there's a little bit of disquiet amongst some Arsenal supporters and everything else, but, you know, I just think these last 18 months, if you will turn out to be about 18 months of absolute chaos, really, that we've all had to suffer with the pandemic. It's hard to judge people in that time.
Dominic, we wish you well. Thanks for being with us, as always.
All the best.
That's Dominic McGuinness joining us there from Manchester. James, time has beaten us from my kitchen to your kitchen. It's been good to chat to you, as always.
Thanks very much, Damien. Great to chat again.
From all of us here, until we chat again, thank you very much for your time.